Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. Today, my guest is Canadian botanical artist Margaret Best. In addition to being an award-winning artist, Margaret is a respected teacher. Her work can be viewed in books, catalogs, magazines, public and private collections, and coins distributed by the Royal Canadian Mint. How did Margaret stumble into this genre? What life experience prepared Margaret for the specialty she's become known for? How does botanical art differ from flower painting? Let's find out. Thank you, Margaret, for stopping by to talk about your work and how you connect people with plants through botanical art and to the natural world through botanical art. You are passionate about what you do. There is no doubt about it. I've known you for a long time, and that's just absolutely no question. You've taught destination workshops in Italy, in Morocco, Canada, England, and Fiji. You've launched a program in Bermuda, and you've helped found a botanical art group in Calgary. You teach at conferences. Your botanical art is in both public and private collections, including the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew and the Hunt Institute for Botanical Documentation at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And you were awarded the Silver Grenfell Medal from the Royal Horticultural Society. Where did this passion come from? And when did you realize that nature was important to you?
Well, I grew up as a child in South Africa of British immigrants. And I realize now that most of my earliest memories of my childhood are linked to nature. We didn't have television in South Africa until really, I think it was well into the 80s. So it caused most South African children to have a very natural life. We were out of doors all the time. Of course, a wonderful climate that allowed for that. But our existence involved being out of doors. And when you're a child filled with curiosity, you're interested in the nature around you. So I can remember some of my earliest memories are watching a line of ants going somewhere, or mostly my parents' gardens, because my parents were avid gardeners. They had that British aspect in their blood, and they reveled in the beautiful climate that they found themselves in. So it goes right back to my childhood.
When did you realize that it was important to you, that nature needed some advocacy? When did you become an advocate?
That really did happen in a more concentrated way when I discovered botanical art. Although I was practicing botanical art before I realized that it was actually an existing genre and that it was gaining momentum globally. We enjoyed camping in our early days of being in Canada, and it meant that we could take our daughter, who was very small at that point, out camping. And I noticed the wildflowers after a Canadian winter that is so long, and nature has been so affected by the cold. When spring starts, there's this incredible awakening. The landscape turns from dull to color. And of course, always being attracted to color and art, I practiced art for many years and in fact had taught art. Just seeing this color again, and it was the wildflowers of Alberta, definitely, that got me back into drawing and really concentrating on fine details. And so when my daughter heard many years later, she was at university, what's this botanical thing you're doing? And I said, let me show you. And she said, but you've always done this. because she could only ever remember me from when she was very young, that I was out and drawing the plants and the wildflowers in particular. They were a distinct stimulus to get that, to get more involved. And then I had a very serendipitous connection in England in 1999 with a well-known botanical artist. And when I saw her work, I was completely blown away. And she just happened to be Anne Swan, a very talented color pencil artist. And she generously shared the whole world of botanical art with me. And it was, you know, some people talk about epiphanies. It was really an epiphany. It really started something in my soul. It caused a whole lot of things to come together. And I remember calling my husband and saying, you know, brace yourself. I'm going to be buying a ton of art materials here because I've met this incredible person and this is what I want to do. So it was an epiphany in terms of the botanical art and that whole connection coming together.
I've always known you as an independent artist. Have you always produced work as an independent artist? And how long have you been a freelance botanical artist?
I started art at the age of 7 when I was found. I made my parents aware that I was very interested in art. But I had showed academic inclinations at school. So my father, who was a very ambitious man for his children, was kind of horrified with this because he's one of my strongest memories of him was saying, artists don't make a living. And you can do math. And you've always said you want to be a teacher. So he was pretty forceful in his recommendations that art stayed a hobby. So I started off in art, and he very generously allowed me to have private tuition with a well-known South African artist. So I had a very classical training in art, and that carried on until I left high school. And I had hinted during that time that the art interest was stronger than the math and science interest, and he again managed to persuade me that being a math teacher was a much better idea and that art could always be a hobby. And it's really interesting that when I got my first teaching post, which was as a math teacher, the art teacher in the school became very ill. And I was asked to step in because of my talents. So I was weaving my arts in my life as an added interest as opposed to a major focus. And so there was that interplay again of science and art, and I really loved the art teaching, and I could see what it did for people. I could see that it would bring out a shy child who never had a forceful appearance in the classroom in academics, but maybe performed in art. And I could see what art did for people that almost nothing else could. I think maybe there's a parallel in sport, but certainly I was very aware of what art could do for people.
What was your first freelance project as a botanical artist? What was that first project that really set you down a clear path?
I've taken many paths, and that's what I've seen sometimes as a bit of a disadvantage to reach the clarity that I have now, because my first entry into botanical art was as an artist. I was very stimulated by Anne Swan and what she had achieved, and she was sitting as an artist in residence. And she explained that she had taught a workshop. So seeing her work and hearing that there was an opportunity in the genre to teach and put those two things together was very interesting to me. But I knew that I would have to gain recognition as an artist. And I wanted to do that too. I wanted to develop my skills. And so I took the path of seeking opportunities as an artist first. And I entered an international juried exhibition, and I didn't get in. And I was horrified. And my ego was bruised. And I think that was a good thing for me, both as an artist, as a teacher, because I can console bruised egos and with my artists that study with me in a very real way. But I also know that that rejection was a major catalyst to find out what I needed to know. And so I did. I set about finding out what is the standard for achievement in an exhibition as an independent artist. What do I need to do? And that helped that. And as I say, in my teaching, which came later, I was able to be truly sympathetic and understanding of what rejection is all about.
You teach a lot, and who enrolls in your workshops? Who is interested in botanical art?
It's really fascinating for me to note that, and I have. Queen Victoria really caused the change between a dominance between male and female ratio involved in this art form. That era caused a lot of women who would really like to be in sciences, but found this as a channel to get into sciences. It was considered acceptable to dabble in sciences through art, and women got together. So I've noted that there's a significantly higher number of women that come to this art form. It's changing. I see more men coming to it. But within that really large group of women, it seems to transcend, and I think this is wonderful, a wide range of people from extremely high positions in government, corporations, whether they are lawyers or financial people.
The people who do botanical art, what do they have in common besides their deep interest and what is it about the art that draws them? Is it the detailed nature of it? Is it the challenge to match nature's colors? Is it the challenge to describe visually what people don't necessarily notice during the day? What is it, do you think?
I think it's actually, in most cases, all of the above, everything you've just said. Because of your own connection, you know already what people are looking for. I think people that botanical art is their central focus, that their family is on board and understands and nurtures this focus. I emphasize that because I'm blessed with a husband that actually told me, leave the family business now and do your thing. Because I was involved in the family business, as I mentioned. So he never questions my passion. It never encroaches. He will make little requests on more of my time. But people that are passionate about this, this is not a summer event. This is not when their gardens are in bloom. This is something that is a core thing, that this connection to nature, this connection to plant life, exists wherever they go. And their curiosity to see and interpret. Now, I do find that quite a few people are particularly interested in a single aspect of this. I know people that are passionate about mushrooms. Mm-hmm. I know people that are passionate about fruit, certain flowering plants, cacti. We could go on and on and on about the special interest groups within this. So, but the core is this passion of learning more and learning and sharing with others the importance of of nature to us as human beings. I think that's what I see a lot.
Yeah.
And that's the common thread, I think, weaving through it all.
So you mentioned earlier that the type of work that you did for the family business revolved around pigments and how that influenced the type of classes that you teach. And you lead in-depth workshops about specific colors. And your botanical, or your classes, you've studied what, green, red, purple, white, blue? What other colors have
Well,
you
I get into the world of what I call neutrals recently because of the setting that I'm living in. Mushrooms have become an interest for me. So there are certain mushrooms that are incredibly brightly colored, but they're by far the biggest group of mushrooms. Most of mushrooms, I should say, are these very soft, beautiful, neutral colors, which most people would look at and say, oh, that's gray or that's brown, but they don't see more. And so I'm very interested in neutrals. It's a class I've added to my list since we did art together. So yes, the business introduced me to the world of pigments, almost the behind the scenes of what went into manufacturing. And I found that manufacturing of house paint, the automotive industry, the makeup industry, we have common pigments. People still seem to think about products in isolation, but not really. I discovered what pigments were better than others. I discovered that pigments could be, they could lose their brilliance, they could lose their color, they could shift to other colors. And then I remembered artists like Van Gogh, whose yellows turned brown, and how he even wrote to his brother and said, I can't afford the pigments that the impressionists can afford. And so my art world was constantly coming into this. And I landed up traveling across Canada teaching ink technicians how to color match. And so that connection of teaching people how to match colors very accurately, I immediately saw a connection, because in botanical art, we're supposed to get as close as we can to the natural thing, not the digital version of the subject. And so I decided that I had something that I'd built up over a period of 22 years of being able to take to the artist and explain some of the mysteries and some of the colors to avoid, a lot of colors to avoid, and the better color choices, and how to make those good choices when they went out shopping, because the world of art supplies is bountiful and confusing. And so then I got into the special categories and focused primarily on the colors that appeared in people's worlds, in their individual worlds, because certainly climate and region affects that. But they were well received. People didn't know a lot of the information, and nothing gives a teacher more of a thrill than finding out that she or he is imparting information that is new. So it's changed, of course, a lot as manufacturers are more into sharing what artists need to know. But initially when I started, that was really not in place at all. It's still growing and improving.
Have you considered ever writing a book about your use of color, your knowledge of color, and the colors in the natural world?
The question of a book comes up over and over. My work has been featured in a few books. There's one coming up, which I can't really talk about, but I'm involved in that. And even yesterday, I had someone say to me, all these, because I've always, with my workshops, I've always provided a small booklet that I've prepared that relates to the topic of the workshop. And my husband believes it isn't a topic I haven't covered because he's always helped me with the printing of these books, and he feels that all I have to do is put them all together. So Tonya, your question about books, I've been concerned lately that there is a plethora of how-to books that are entering the market. And I don't want to do another how-to book. Most of the very well-known artists who also teach have done how-to books. Some of them are excellent. Some of them are wanting. Some of them are dated the day they write them because materials keep changing. So I've looked at all these different aspects. I don't want to do another how-to book. I'm really as passionate about the history of this art form as much as I am about the art form. And that passion has led me to look at how color was used through the ages by different renowned artists and what they could access, because a lot of them had to buy pigments and make their own paint before manufacturers were making them. And so I've done a lot of research in that. And so I'm searching to find the best avenue for putting something meaningful together. I've got a lot of people who've got ideas on this, and I'm looking at them, you know, from my husband's saying, market all your books, all these workshop books that people write to you and say, can I pay for, or are surreptitiously copying or despite my copyright notes. And so, yeah, I've got to do something about it. And I think the time is now, because we made this big move across Canada. And a move is, it was right across the country, and a big change. And so that really occupied my time. So, yes. It was a long way round of telling you I'm interested in doing a book, and its actual form has not yet materialized.
What if you did a See This book? What would that look like?
A See This book, would that be
as opposed to a how-to?
I'm really against a how-to. I really want a book that offers really good information, whether it's about a particular plant, because many of my workshops have been about plants. Mm-hmm. I did a workshop on orchids in Bermuda, landed up talking to the Orchid Society. The Botanical a Garden Society, but there were people from the Orchid Society. So a lot of my teaching has involved specific plants. So I can't really take that out of the equation. I don't want to take color out of the equation. So what did you call, repeat again?
A See This book. Because through your color classes, you show people things that they can't unsee. Okay. And so you're all about seeing. You build a career about seeing.
That's a very good point.
What if your book was a See This book? What if that were your posture? Would that look like?
What would it look like? Wow, Tonya, you've given me food for thought here. I don't know if I can adequately answer it off the cuff, but...
I'm tossing it out there, Margaret.
I like it. Nobody's put it that way before. I get a lot of people who put it their way, and I have to sit and mull it over. I like that one. You've given me a lot of food for thought here.
And so since we're talking about seeing, as I said, you've built a career about centered around seeing and observing and capturing the energy and movement of plants. And something that I really like about your work is that you show motion. Botanical art is, you know, a lot of center of the page, a presentation of the plant and the plant's habit and all. And it's beautiful. It's always done exquisitely. But what I like about yours is that there's movement. There's something swaying or something flowing or bending. And
I want to share with you that you were the first person to tell me that many years ago. And it stopped me in my tracks. And I said, really? And I went back and looked at a number of them and I thought, wow, she's right. I do. And it's quite often something that pops into my head that I need to get this into. What caused that? I'm not sure. My composition approach was heavily influenced by Pandora Sellers. That was one of the things that attracted me to her work, besides the technical brilliance. She gave me permission to not show the entire plant in every painting, not to have this floating vignette in a sea of white space. And I say this in when I teach compositions, to see the page as a window. And what can you put into that window that will make people look at it? Because I see botanical art as an educational force. It's a chance to get someone to look at nature in a way they've never before. And I think that huge amount of detail is one of the catalysts for that. But if you can say something about the plant that indicates how they sway in the breeze, how they bend in the pollination process, how you can bring other influences besides the obvious into the equation. I'm thinking of a painting that I did think about you when I was doing it, and I don't know if you know it. It was in the Art of the Woods exhibition. It was of a pandanus tree, and I found it in the Bermuda Botanical Garden. But my first connection with a pandanus tree, which is not in Canada, it's a tropical tree, was when one exploded in a house in which I was in Bermuda on my own, and I was absolutely terrified. I thought somebody had broken in, or a tree had collapsed on the house. I really couldn't identify that noise. And when I crept into the living room with a flashlight going, there was this exploded pandanus. And so I knew I'd known for years I wanted to paint the pandanus fruit. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But then I thought, I have to show it exploding.
Mm-hmm.
And by showing it exploding, I'm sharing how it disperses its seeds. So the way plants disperse their seeds is fascinating and, you know, endless. And I know I'm going to find more that I don't know about now. But I thought that had to come into it. And so, and I think that's one of my best paintings, if I had to. And you didn't ask that question. Because it shows movement, because it describes what you're saying. So, as I say, you were the first person to tell me you saw that. And that excited me. And the compositions became later through Pandora's influence. And I try to bring it in, not always consciously, but I'm happy when it's there.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. I need to thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome, Margaret. Botanical art is as you've mentioned, a wonderful introduction to the botanical world and to plants. And, you know, there is this issue of plant blindness that exists, where people tend to be more familiar with animals than they are with plants. What have you learned about people's relationships with plants through all of your teaching? Now, granted, people who go take your workshop, they're self-selected. They already have some type of an interest in plants. I would think it's safe to assume. But to what depth is their relationship with plants?
The people that come to the workshops, that varies. That varies between people who say to me, I love flowers. Mm-hmm. And I'm very careful to say this is not all about flowers. there's flower painting for people who love flowers. This is so much more. This embraces each plant's growth pattern, how they are pollinated, how they fruit. Are the fruits a human food source? There's so much more. We look at the whole plant. We don't just look at the beautiful flower. Although I will share that there are some magnificent botanical artists who focus on flowers. So I'm very careful to say that it's way beyond just flowers. What I'm finding of late, as we all become more aware of endangered plants, as we begin to realize that we as humans have endangered them, not deliberately, but in pursuit of all kinds of things that are not as, do not contribute to our planet. And of course, plunderers that are out for greed, that are destroying the rainforests, and we could go on and on and on. I find that people are way more interested in the environment and the protection of the environment than ever before. And I like that. And as I always say that, yes, I'm a teacher of this art form, but one of the key attractions to me is the learning that it affords me. Every painting, every new subject is a new learning experience. And you need to find out where that plant exists in the world and what it contributes. And that needs to come out in the painting. That's my feeling.
What's next for you?
Well, we did have that little mention of a book there. I do need to address how I can channel the years I have been teaching, producing educational material, how I can channel that into a book effectively in this genre that's exploded and has many people launching books into it. What's next for me is I need to create a better balance between my teaching and my own creating. I mentioned that I've moved to a completely new setting. It's a setting that has me in inspiration overload. From long, long winter months where I had to go to supermarkets looking for subjects, in terms of plants or fruits and vegetables. I made a joke to Michael, my husband, in the summer, there's something going on in my garden every hour. There's a change going on there every hour. What the heck? And I have so many subjects that are lining up that I want to paint and don't get to. I've done masses and masses of drawings. And then when I open my box of drawings, I said, oh, yeah, what about that one? What about that one? So to put it, to summarize that, I want to paint more because I'm passionate about the setting that I'm in. I'm really passionate about the setting I'm in. It's brought so much to my world that is meaningful. When I moved here, as I mentioned, I was going to stay here for a period of time, find out what I needed to know about the plant world here, find out about the community that I'm living in, and I didn't expect to launch right away. That was not a plan. And as it started to grow and people wanted more and more, as I say, I have a hard time saying no. So I did too much teaching this year because I was plugging in the local people with my already established, I plan a year in advance with plus. And so it became too much. I exhausted myself trying to be everything to everybody and I want to paint because I'm in the stimulation overload. So I've said time out. I set a time out in December. And I've started on a path of painting more and balancing the teaching. And so that's what's going to happen. I'm pretty firm about it. because I enjoy the painting as much as I enjoy the teaching. And you have to learn how to focus better and how to achieve your own goals. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm hoping to do.
You teach so much through your paintings, Margaret.
That's important. And you know, Tanya, I worry where this genre is going sometimes, because there's a much bigger emphasis on saturated color, which is what all these digital tools have brought into the equation. I'm not against change. I'm not against scientific developments that enhance painting. I'm sure Leonardo would have had an iPad or an iPhone if he'd known about them, or they were even, he didn't dream about that, did he? I've read many books about him recently, and he was incredible. But I still feel, and there are artists that I connect with. There's a wonderful artist in England called Coral Guest, and we communicate. And she talks about the soul of the plant and a devotion to the plant that has to be there, rather than just a plant that you've taken in a split second on your iPhone, take it home and reproduce. That plant connection is enormous, and I'm determined to keep that thread of plant connection and plant information that you need to put out through your paintings. I'm not into making the painting, the science side of things, dominate my painting, because as I've explained to you, I really came to this with an art side of things. Yes, science was in the mix, but it wasn't the dominant force. Art was. And so I understand fine artists. I understand that there are many artists that have come into our world. Some people might say poached our world. I think that if they stay around long enough, they see that education side of it. They see the teaching to the viewer that needs to be there. So I'm hopeful for the genre, but I also am very aware of how some of the edges can get frayed and the intent of this art form can be diminished.
Okay, so what should be next for botanical art? You explained what's next for you. What should be next for botanical art, you think?
Much more in the arena of how do we preserve what we have. And I think that message has started. I think that the American Society of Botanical Artists has made major strides in leading that direction. This is not just a society for members of like minds to gather together. They, through that tree exhibition, created a focus for arboretums, or trees in public spaces, not only trees in forests, but public spaces where people can actually connect with them. I think that kind of direction is where I hope it's going, that really focuses on our planet and what we're doing to it and what we're doing to the plant kingdom. The ASBA is coming up with, there's an exhibition coming up with heirloom plants. Plants, many of them are endangered. I went to a talk that the ASBA gave, and I learned that bananas, it's a staple. It's one of the 10 staple foods that exist globally. We can't afford for them to go to disappear. We need to preserve them. We've got to stop playing with the genetics of these things in a negative way for mass production and focus how they can be maintained to the entire global community. So I think that botanical art needs to move in that direction and offer a public message of preservation more than ever. I hope it does. But I do see that organizations like the American Society is part of that movement.
Thank you, Margaret.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to say that you haven't said?
I think you mentioned the community. And one of the joys of moving into this region where I have has been a connection with people in the community that have massive plant knowledge, that are people that are typically shy, people that don't seek the public eye, but have a knowledge that is immense. Included in that group, I'm going to mention Aboriginal people. The First Nation people have always had a massive knowledge about medicinal aspects of plants. But I'm also going to speak about people that have come into my world that I've been able to tap into that support my workshops. For example, by living in a forested area, I've discovered with great joy mushrooms. Because where there are trees, there are mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And the symbiotic relationship that exists in many cases. And I discovered, I thought, well, forest floor, wouldn't that be a great topic for a workshop? And when I started to explore that, it branched off in ferns. Well, it turns out there is a fern specialist about 15 kilometers from me. I haven't even talked to him yet. But when I did a workshop on heirloom fruits, I discovered a retired Emerge doctor who has heirloom orchards and has had this passion for decades. He was a fabulous resource. And to bring him in and educate the artists about that passion, and it made such a wonderful dimension to the whole learning experience. I have since discovered, since I got the interest in the forest floor as a topic, we have a mycologist very close to me, and she has opened up my world. I'm painting mushrooms like crazy now because I love them, and I love their colors. I love the whole setting in which they grow, and I've discovered that certain mushrooms grow around certain trees, and so you bring in elements of the tree and so forth. So the involving the community, the experts, the plant experts in the community has been very exciting for me, because not only can they unleash a whole lot of secrets in a hurry and take interesting directions, but they can make the artist's experience so much more meaningful.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing that I thought of, that there's maybe something that your audience in podcasts would like to know, that we need to nurture existing knowledge before it disappears. And that knowledge comes from people who have that connection with plants, not through art, but for other reasons. And to tap into that makes what we do more meaningful.
To learn more about Margaret, visit the show notes for this episode. Here you will find links to her website, her social media accounts, as well as links to artists and resources mentioned in this episode. Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.